information operations can meaningfully shift hearts and minds. That change in civilian behavior goes hand in hand with a meaningful shift in the ability to actually provide public services.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. The battlefield is not necessarily a field anymore. It's in the minds of the people. That's not a quote from an academic political theorist or some guerrilla leader. It is from a 2010 speech by Admiral Michael Mullen, who was then the chair of the US Joint Chiefs of Staff. But many people are still skeptical that modern information operations are useful or effective, especially when they are used by forces from outside the country. Austin Wright of the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago is one of the authors of a new paper, I took Admiral Mullen's quote from it, that systematically evaluates one of these operations by US forces in Afghanistan, and he joins me now. Austin, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hello, Tim. Thanks for having me on.
Austin, this term information operations that we're using today, is this just jargon for what we used to call in the old days propaganda?
I mean, I think that's a somewhat fair characterization. You know, information operations pertain to a large number of potential pieces of information that could be shared, some of which is persuasive in nature, some of which is simply informative in nature. And so it's a term that encompasses a broad array in this messaging space, some of which would be classically called propaganda, some of which would just be called a public service announcement, for example. Information operations in this paper goes beyond simply what would classically be thought of as propaganda and addresses both of these features, just the persuasive element and, because of the nature of this particular operation, also what happens when you simply provide civilians with information about the local security environment, the harm that's being done by certain combatants and things of that nature.
And we can assume from what Admiral Mullen was saying that it's fairly common today. What examples are there around the world of how it's being used?
The ones that immediately come to mind for me are similar programs that were run in Iraq that involved messaging as well as, you know, public service announcements. And another really important conflict where this was used, you know, rather successfully by a number of metrics is the Colombian conflict, which fortunately, at least to some degree, came to an end recently.
Your work has focused on one aspect of the conflict in Afghanistan. But since the US withdrawal a few months ago, the dominant narrative that you see about Afghanistan is that this was a colossal failure for the United States. And a big part of that is because it did fail to win those hearts and minds of the Afghan people. Is that a fair characterization?
I do think that's a fair characterization, both a tactical failure as well as a failure to maintain political and economic stability. The thing is, Afghanistan is going through probably one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world right now. And that in no small measure is due to the inability of the new government led by the Taliban to adequately deliver aid to rural communities, attract support from the international community. You know, this isn't to say that, you know, in a counterfactual world where the old government, the Ghani administration, was able to maintain power, that things would be daisies and rainbows. But I think it would be fair to characterize that as at least part of the crisis they face now is because of a crisis of government. This political instability is a marked element of failure. And I do think that it's reasonable to say that this is at least in part a failure to win hearts and minds. The key thing that we're studying is whether or not an international actor can intervene in an area that was previously under rebel control and use messaging, you know, what we call information operations, to shift the allegiances of the local population to enhance the effectiveness of security forces in providing that very thing, security. What we find is that it did work. The key thing to remember is whether or not those same lessons translate into a tool that could be used by a central authority. Could they use the same tools to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan people? Plausibly, yes. Today, pretty clearly, no. So I do a fair amount of work on Afghanistan. Another big project that we recently wrapped up was a project on the withdrawal, the inability to win hearts and minds. Is that that's one side of the coin? I think the other side of the coin is that the United States and the international community, as well as local actors, continued to underestimate the ability of the Taliban to make a credible case that they would be a better government, or at least that the Ghani government was not the government that would lead them to prosperity.
You focused in this paper on one specific information operation in one region. So what happened in this operation?
The program that we're interested in studying is something called Radio in a Box. Mm-hmm. And it was a very particular kind of messaging using radio that could be deployed to rural outposts because it came literally in a box. Mm-hmm. It was the transmitter, the antenna, and a bunch of the other pieces of technology that you need to get a radio station stood up in an area where no, at least FM radio signal would have been present. And that's exactly the context that we're studying. And so what we're able to evaluate is the location of one of these radio in a box sites. The location happens to be Garmzer District in Helmand, which was an area under Taliban control up until 2010. So you can imagine this is going to be one of the hardest cases to potentially shift allegiances. Mm-hmm. And we're able to study the impact of the installation and initiation of programming at a very particular site inside of Garmzer that happened to effectively treat some communities with radio messaging because they were exposed, given the technological characteristics of the tower, whereas their neighbors just across the exposure line were significantly less likely to receive the messaging. It's an area of tremendous tactical value when the program was rolled out in 2010, 2011. I should also say that, you know, we're able to study this in one region. That wasn't the only place a radio in the box was initiated. There were dozens of other sites. We just lack information about their location. They're not in the public domain, and this is the one that we were able to study.
What is considered success for this operation? What are you measuring here, and how does that success happen?
This is a great question. It's not just that we want hearts and minds to change for no reason, or I should say the actors on the ground. What they were after is a shift in the willingness of civilians to cooperate mm-hmm. with security forces to provide information about the location of threats, particularly roadside bombs. Hope is that you could convert this information about the location of these roadside bombs into what are called clearance operations. So find and clear missions where IED patrols would go out to a site after receiving a tip about a potential IED location, and then hopefully having an opportunity both to find that IED, to defuse it, or to remove it, defuse it, and then neutralize it away from an area where it could have potentially impacted either civilians or combatant forces. The back end of your question is also really nice, which is, did they assume it would work? I think there is this assumption around the time the program is rolled out that you really can influence hearts and minds through persuasive and informative messaging. This was based on a counterinsurgency doctrine that the United States military had adopted. But the reason why I like this question so much is actually very little, at least up until we think this particular project, was known about effectiveness, right? So the key thing here is, as you put it, they had assumed it would work, but there was very little rigorous evidence. Actually, we think there was no rigorous evidence up until we started working on this project to tell us whether or not a program of this nature could work in a difficult case.
So Austin, how as well do you get the data to find out if it is achieving its goals?
In 2014-15, myself and a colleague, another graduate student, were in the right place at the right time mm-hmm. and received access to what are called significant activity reports. And so SIGACs, as they're known for short, that are kept on combatant engagement and military operations. And so in Afghanistan, that totaled more than 400,000 unique observations that were tracked. And those types of operations that are tracked are exactly the kinds of things that we study here. Things like find and clear missions, but other events that are tracked include reported threats, including reported locations of IEDs and civilian attempts to neutralize IEDs. And so that data comes from the U.S. military through Central Command, it's formally declassified, and that allows us to trace with very fine precision both where and when civilians are cooperating with security forces, and again, the precise information where and when counterinsurgents are able to go and clear those bombs that were actually reported.
So what's the data telling us? Was this operation effective?
Yeah, it told us that after the introduction of this radio tower, communities within the reach of the radio tower experienced a significant increase in cooperation relative to very similar communities outside of radio penetration. And corresponding to the shift in information about the battle space and about threats that both civilians and soldiers were experiencing in this district in the affected areas, you see a significant increase in find and clear missions that correspond to when and where civilians are reporting the location of roadside bombs.
But conflict zones can be pretty confusing places, can't they? There's a lot going on. There's constant change. How sure can you be that you have identified a causal effect here?
This is another really, really nice question. And the truth is, we never know whether or not what we've estimated is a causal effect. And in our case, what we're taking advantage of is a quasi-experimental design. Hmm. We're not the ones who chose the location of the radio tower. We're not the ones who chose when the tower would go into place. We didn't direct where operations were going to be deployed to find and clear missions. Now, we have a number of tests that we are able to take advantage of, both because we have information from an officer who was deployed to this area and had gone on patrol and could give us information about the extent of radio coverage. But we can also, and this is another new thing that we're able to do in this paper, we take advantage of a series of different plausible features of the radio tower. Again, because the characteristics of this tower, although we know the location, the technical features are still quite highly classified. But we know, based off of digging in archival materials, roughly what the strength of the tower would have been, roughly what the height of the tower would have been. And we can test a series of bounds on some of these features rather than relying on the field report that we have, which we think is very accurate. We can simply turn to an engineering model to study these changes. Places under conflict are exposed to constant flux. And you know, it could have been the case that some of these dynamics are simply driven by other changes in conflict dynamics. But fortunately, again, because of the quality of the data that we have, we can actually evaluate these claims. And indeed, what we find is highly robust to accounting for changes, both in the tactics that are used by insurgents, as well as other counterinsurgent operations that would have been occurring at roughly the same time. So we think that we have plausible estimates. We definitely think we have the sign in the right direction.
Hearing what you had to do, I am not surprised that there isn't much, well, there isn't any rigorous research on this question, but now you have a result. What do we learn from it?
I think what we learn, which is not terribly surprising, is that information operations can meaningfully shift hearts and minds. I say that's not terribly surprising because that's what counterinsurgency doctrine had been assuming. Mm-hmm. But it is rather surprising if you think about it in the context of a civilian population, again, especially in this context that have been exposed to fairly consistent Taliban presence and ability to control this particular region. What we see here is actually a really difficult case to find that change. And we still see it. And so what that suggests to us, and hopefully is more broadly reflective of the effectiveness of this kind of program, is that those changes in civilian behavior can have a meaningful consequence in the battlefield. We're documenting these features for roughly the first time. Mm-hmm. And certainly in this context, being able to link these dynamics is the first time. And so again, that information operations can change civilian behavior, but also being able to demonstrate that that change in civilian behavior goes hand in hand with a meaningful shift in the ability of, in this case, the security forces, but you could think more broadly, a government to actually provide public services, which again, in this highly specialized case, is the ability to clear roadside bombs. We think that both of these are really important and hopefully reflect how information operations would impact civilian behavior and government success in other contexts as well.
we can think of this as a very good news story. We might also think of this as a very bad news story as well, mightn't we? Because information operations, they can also be used to stir up prejudice, create hatred. There are examples of that from history. Is this research also a warning to us that we must be aware of that potential to create conflict?
When we started working on this project, we had a little bit of this in mind. In fact, The very first version of the introduction that we talked through is that most of the work that has been done previously in this space, and I think to bring it full circle, to go back to your very first question, what's the difference between an information operation and propaganda? Most prior work is very squarely on propaganda. And most of that prior work that's been done very, very well in economics and political science is focused on the ability for propaganda to be used to amplify prejudice, to stir up hatred, as you put it, And significantly less the ability to use messaging to shift hearts and minds in a positive direction. And thinking through how this particular campaign was rolled out, you could imagine that it could also be used by the other side. Although I should say that, you know, the Taliban, and this is quite well documented, they very deliberately engage in messaging already. So nothing in our paper could be misappropriated by the Taliban. But I do think you're right that it has the potential to broader lesson could be used to advance hatred. And I think another thing that we have to be mindful of, which is a slight alteration of the question, is could these information operations go wrong? And the answer is yes. They certainly could. And there are cases where unintentionally included culturally insensitive content actually made the security situation significantly worse. And I think what this does is it highlights the importance always to remember the cultural context, also that information operations can go awry.
Never more relevant than it is today. Austin, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks again for having me, Tim. Really appreciate it.
The paper's called Information Operations Increase Civilian Security Cooperation, and the authors are Konstantin Sonin and Austin Wright. Austin, I believe that you got a journal acceptance for this.
So the paper has been conditionally accepted at the Economic Journal. We're in the final steps, and we're excited that hopefully it'll see a home there.
Hopefully it will see a large audience as well. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform and all our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org.